The Fraud of Feminism, Part 4, The Anti-Man Crusade. As regards the offence of bigamy, for which a man commonly receives a heavy sentence of penal servitude, I think I may venture to state, without risking contradiction, that no woman during recent years has been imprisoned for this offence. The statute law, while conferring distinct privileges upon married women as to the control of their property and for trading separately and apart from their husbands, renders them exempt from the ordinary liabilities incurred by a male trader as regards proceedings under the Debtors' Acts and the Bankruptcy Law. In the case of Lady Bateman v. Faber and others reported in Chancery Appeal cases, the Master of the Rolls, Sir N. Lindley, is reported to have said that the authorities showed that a married woman could not, by hook or by crook, even by her own fraud, deprive herself of restraint upon anticipation. He would say nothing as to the policy of the law, but it had been affirmed by the Married Woman's Property Act. The Act of 1882 was being referred to. And the result was that a married woman could play fast and loose to an extent to which no other person could. And by this no other person, we presume him to be talking about a male person. It has indeed been held to such a length. Does the law extend its protection and privileges to the female, that even the concealment by a wife from the husband at the time of marriage that she was then pregnant by another man is still no ground for declaring the marriage null and void? The above may be taken as a fair all-around, although by no means an exhaustive, statement of the present one-sided condition of the civil law as regards the relation of husband and wife. We will now pass on to the consideration of the relative incidence of the criminal law on the two sexes. We will begin with the crime of murder. The law of murder is still ostensibly the same for both sexes, but in effect the application of its provisions in the two cases is markedly different. As, however, these differences lie, as just stated, not in the law itself, but rather in its administration, we can only give in this place where we are dealing with the principles of law rather than their application, a general formula of the mode in which the administration of the law of murder proceeds, which, briefly stated, is as follows. The evidence, even to secure conviction in the case of a woman, must be many times stronger than that which would suffice to hang a man. Should a conviction be obtained, the death penalty, though pronounced, is not given effect to, the female prisoner being almost invariably reprieved. In most cases, where there is conviction at all, it is for manslaughter, and not for murder, when a light or almost nominal sentence is passed. Cases confirming what is here said will be given later on. There is one point, however, to be observed here, and that is the crushing incidence of the law of libel. This means that no case of any woman, however notoriously guilty on the evidence, can be quoted after she has been acquitted by a feminist jury, as the law holds such to be innocent and provides them with a remedy in a libel action. Now, seeing that most women accused of murder are acquitted irrespective of the evidence, it is clear that the writer is fatally handicapped so far as confirmation of his thesis by cases is concerned. Women are, to all intents and purposes, allowed to harass men when they conceive they have a grievance at their own sweet will, the magistrate usually telling their victim that he cannot interfere. In the opposite case, that of a man harassing a woman, the latter has invariably to find sureties for his future good behaviour, or else he goes to jail. One of the most famous enactments indicative of feminist sex bias is the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1886. The act itself was led up to, with the usual effect, by an unscrupulous newspaper agitation in the feminist and Puritan interest, designed to create a panic in the public mind, under the influence of which legislation of this description can generally be rushed through Parliament. The reckless disregard of the commonest principles of justice and common sense of this abominable statute may be seen in the shameless sex privilege it accords the female in the matter of seduction. Under its provisions, a boy of 14 years can be prosecuted and sent to jail for an offence to which he has been instigated by a girl just under 16 years, whom the law, of course, on the basis of the aforesaid sex privileges, holds guiltless. The outrageous infamy of this provision is especially apparent when we consider the greater precocity of the average girl as compared with the average boy of this age. We now come to the latest piece of anti-man legislation, the so-called White Slave Trade Act of 1912. This statute was, as usual, rushed through the legislature on the wave of a factitious public excitement organised for the purpose, and backed up by the usual faked statements and exaggerated allegations, the whole matter being three parts bogus and deliberate lying. The alleged dangers of the unprotected female were, for the object of the agitation, purposely exaggerated in the proverbial proportion of the mountain to the molehill. But as regards many of those most eager in promoting this piece of anti-man legislation, there were probably special psychological reasons to account for their attitude. The special features of the bill in question are 1. Increased powers given to the police in the matter of arrest on suspicion, and 2. The flogging clauses. Up till now, the flogging of garrotters was justified against opponents by its upholders on the ground of the peculiarly brutal nature of the offence of highway robbery with violence. It should be noted that in the act in question, no such excuse can apply, for it is appointed to be inflicted for offences which, whatever else they may be, do not in their nature involve violence, and hence which cannot be described as brutal in the ordinary sense of the term. The anti-man nature of the whole measure, as of the agitation itself which preceded it, is conclusively evidenced by the fact that while it is well known that the number of women gaining a living by procuration is much greater than the number of men engaged therein, comparatively little vituperation was heard against the female delinquents in the matter, and certainly none of the vitriolic ferocity that was poured out upon the men alleged to participate in the traffic. A corresponding distinction was represented in the measure itself by the allocation of the torture of the lash to men alone. It is clear, therefore, that the zeal for the suppression of the traffic in question was not the sole motive in the ardour of the flogging fraternity. Even the anti-manism at the back of the whole of this class of legislation seems insufficient to account for the outbreak of bestial bloodlust, for the tigerish ferocity of which the flogging clauses in the Act are the outcome. There is, I take it, no doubt that psychical sexual aberration plays a not inconsiderable part in many of those persons, in a word, that they are labouring under some degree of homosexual sadism. The lustful glee on the part of the aforesaid persons, which greets the notion of the partial flaying alive, for that is what the cat means, of some poor wretch who has succumbed to the temptation of getting his livelihood by an improper method, is hardly to be explained by any other hypothesis. Experts allege that traces of psychosexual aberration are latent in many persons where it would be the least expected, and it is, prima facie, likely enough that these latent tendencies in both men and women should become active under the cover of an agitation in favour of purity and anti-sexuality, to the point of gratifying itself with the thought of torture inflicted upon men. A psychosexual element of another kind doubtless also plays a not unimportant role in the agitation of ladies in favour of that abomination, social purity, which being interpreted generally means lubricity turned upside down. The fiery zeal manifested by many of those ladies for the suppression of the male sex is assuredly not without its pathological significance. The monstrosity of the recent white slave traffic enactment and its savage anti-male vindictiveness is shown not merely, as already observed, in the agitation which preceded it, with its exaggerated vilification of the male offenders in the matter of procuration, and its passing over with comparative slight censure the more numerous female offenders, or in the general spirit animating the act itself, but it is noticeable in the very preposterous exaggeration of its provisions. For example, in the section dealing with the souteneur, the framers of this act and the previous criminal law amendment acts, to which this latest one is merely supplementary, are not satisfied with penalising the man, who has no other means of subsistence beyond what he derives from the wages of some female friend's prostitution, but they strike with impartial rigour the man who knowingly lives wholly or in part from such a source. If, therefore, the clause were taken in its strictest sense, any poor out-at-elbow man who accepted the hospitality of a woman of doubtful virtue in the matter of a drink or a dinner would put himself within the pale of this clause in the act and might be duly flayed by the cat in consequence. The most flagrant case occurred in a London police court in March 1913, in which a youth of 18 years, against whose general character nothing was alleged, and who was known to be in employment as a carman, was sentenced to a month's hard labour under the following circumstances. It was reported that he had been living with a woman, apparently considerably older than himself, whom admittedly he had supported by his own exertions and, when this was insufficient, even by the pawning of his clothes, and whom as soon as he discovered she was earning money by prostitution, he had left. Would it be believed that a prosecution was instituted by the police against this young man under the iniquitous White Slave Traffic Act? But what seems still more incredible is that the magistrate, presumably a sane gentleman, after admitting that the poor fellow was more sinned against than sinning, did not hesitate to pass on him a sentence of 1 month's hard labour. Of course, the woman, who was the head and front of the offending, if offending there was, remained untouched. The above is a mild specimen of justice as meted out in our police courts for men only. Quite recently, there was a case in the north of England of a carter who admittedly worked at his calling, but who, it was alleged, was assisted by women with whom he had lived. Now, this unfortunate man was sentenced to a long term of imprisonment plus flogging. For the judges, of course, any extension of their power over the prisoner in the dock is a godsend. It is quite evident that they are revelling in their new privilege to inflict torture. One of them had the shamelessness recently to boast of the satisfaction it gave him, and to sneer at those of his colleagues who did not make full use of their judicial powers in this direction. The bogus nature of the reasons urged in favour of the most atrocious clauses of this abominable act came out clearly enough in the speeches of the official spokesman of the government in its favour. For example, Lord Haldane, in the House of Lords, besought the assembled peers to bethink themselves of the unhappy victim of the souteneur. He drew a picture of how a heartless bully might beat, starve and otherwise ill-treat his victim, besides taking away her earnings. He omitted to explain how the heartless bully in a free country could coerce his victim to remain with him against her will. He ignored the existence of the police or of a whole army of social purity busybodies and vigilant societies for whom her case would be a tasty morsel only too eagerly snapped at. If the victim does not avail herself of any of those means of escape so ready to her hand, the presumption is that she prefers the company of her alleged brutal tyrant to that of the chaste Puritan ladies of the vigilance societies. To those who follow the present state of artificially fermented public opinion in the matter, Lord Haldane's suggestion that there was any danger of the precious victim not being sufficiently slobbered over will seem to be not without a touch of humour. Furthermore, as illustrating the utter illogicality of the line taken by the promoters of this act, for whom Lord Haldane acted as the mouthpiece, we have only to note the fact that the measure does not limit the penalties awarded to cases accompanied by circumstances of aggravation, such as Lord Haldane pictures, which it might easily have done, but extends it impartially to all cases, whether accompanied by cruelty or not. We can hardly imagine that a man of Lord Haldane's intellectual power and general humanity should not have been aware of the hollowness of the case he had to put as an official advocate and of the rottenness of the conventional arguments he had to state in its support. When confronted with the unquestionably true contention that corporal punishments, especially such as are of a savage and vindictive kind, are degrading alike to the inflictors of them and to those who are their victims, he replied that criminals in the cases in question were already so degraded that they could not be degraded further. One would imagine he could hardly have failed to know that he was talking pernicious twaddle. It is obvious that this argument, in addition to it being untrue, in fact opens the floodgates to brutal penal legislation all round, so far at least as the more serious offences are concerned. One could equally well assert of murder, burglary, even abuse to confidants in some cases, and other offences, that the perpetrators of them must be so degraded that no amount of brutal punishment could degrade them further. Everybody can regard the crime to which he has a pet aversion, more than other crimes, as indicating the perpetrator thereof to be outside the pale of humanity. But as regards the particular case in point, let us for a moment clear our minds of cant upon the subject. Procuration, and also living on the proceeds of prostitution, may be morally abominable methods of securing a livelihood, though even here, as in most other offences, there may be circumstances of palliation in individual cases. Yet after all is said and done, it is doubtful whether, apart from any fraud or misrepresentation, which of course places it altogether in a different category, these ought to be regarded as criminal offences. To offer facilities, or to act as an agent for women who are anxious to lead a gay life, or even to suggest such a course to women, so long as prostitution itself is not recognised by the law as crime, however reprehensible morally, would scarcely seem to transcend the limits of legitimate individual liberty. In any case, the constituting of such an action, a crime must surely open out an altogether new principle in jurisprudence, and one of far-reaching consequences. The same remarks apply, even more forcibly, to the question of sharing the earnings of a prostitute. Prostitution per se is not, in the eyes of the law, a crime, or even a misdemeanour. The woman who makes her living as a prostitute is under the protection of the law, and the money she receives from her customer is recognised as her property. If she, however, in the exercise of her right of free disposition of that property, gives some of it to a male friend, that friend, by the mere acceptance of a free gift, becomes a criminal in the eyes of the law. Anything more preposterous, judging by all hitherto recognised principles of jurisprudence, can scarcely be imagined. Even from the moral point of view of the class of cases coming under the purview of the Act, of men who in part share in the proceeds of their female friends' traffic, must involve many instances in which no sane person, i.e. one who has not been bitten by the rabid man-hatred of the feminist and the social purity monger, must regard the moral obliquity involved as not very serious. Take, for instance, the case of a man who is out of work, who is perhaps starving, and receives temporary assistance of this kind. Would any reasonable person allege that such a man was in the lowest depths of moral degradation? Still less, that he merited for this breach, at most, of fine delicacy of feeling, the flaying alive prescribed by the Act under consideration. Besides all this, it is well known that some women, shop assistants, and others, gain part of their living by their reputable avocation and part in another way. Now, presumably the handing over of a portion of her regular salary to her lover would not constitute the latter a flayable criminal, but the endowment of him with a portion of any of the presents obtained by her pursuit of her other calling would do so. The process of earmarking the permissible and the impermissible gift strikes one as very difficult, even if it were possible.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
The point last referred to leads us on to another reflection. If the man who, in whole or in part, lives on the proceeds of a woman's prostitution, is of necessity a degraded wretch outside the pale of all humanity, as he is represented to be by the flogging fraternity, how about the employer or employeress of female labour who bases his or her scale of wages on the assumption that the girls and women he or she employs supplement these wages by presents received after working hours for their sexual favours, in other words, by prostitution? Many of these employers of labour are doubtless to be found among the noble band of advocates of the white slave traffic bills, flogging and social purity. The above persons, of course, are respectable members of society, while a souteneur is an outcast. In addition to the motives before alluded to, as actuating the promoters of the factitious and bogus so-called white slave agitation, there is one very powerful political and economic motive which must not be left out of sight. In view of the existing labour unrest, it is highly desirable from the point of view of our possessing and governing classes that popular attention should be drawn off labour wrongs and labour grievances onto something less harassing to the capitalist and official mind. Now the anti-man agitation forms a capital red herring for drawing the popular scent off class opposition by substituting sex antagonism in its place. If you can set public opinion off on the question of wicked man and downtrodden woman, you have done a good deal to help the capitalistic enterprise to tide over the present crisis. The insistence of public opinion on better conditions for the labourer will thus be weakened by being diverted into urging forward vindictive laws against men and for placing as far as may be the whole power of the state at the disposal of the virago, the shrew, the female sharper in their designs upon their male victim. Or, be it remembered, it is always the worst type of woman to whom the advantage of laws passed as the result of the anti-man campaign accrues. The real nature of the campaign is crucially exhibited in some of the concrete demands put forward by its advocates. One of the measures proposed in the so-called Woman's Charter, drawn up with the approval of all prominent feminists by Lady McLaren, now Lady Abba Conway, some 4 or 5 years back, and which had been previously advocated by other feminist writers, was to the effect that a husband, in addition to his other liabilities, should be legally compelled to pay a certain sum to his wife, ostensibly as wages for her housekeeping services, no matter whether she performs the services well or ill or not at all. Whatever the woman is, or does, the husband has to pay all the same. Another of the clauses in this precious document is to the effect that a wife is to be under no obligation to follow her husband, compelled, probably, by the necessity of earning a livelihood for himself and her, to any place of residence outside the British Islands. That favourite crank of the feminist of raising the age of consent, with the result of increasing the number of victims of the designing young female, should speak for itself to every unbiased person. One of the proposals which finds most favour with the sentimental feminist is the demand that in the case of the murder by a woman of her illegitimate child, the putative father should be placed in the dock as an accessory. In other words, a man should be punished for a crime of which he is wholly innocent, because the guilty person was forsooth a woman. That such a suggestion should be so much as entertained by otherwise sane persons is indeed significant of the degeneracy of mental and moral fibre induced by the feminist movement, for it may be taken as typical. It reminds me of a feminist friend of mine who, challenged by me, sought, for long in vain, to find a case in the courts in which a man was unduly favoured at the expense of a woman. At last, he succeeded in lighting upon the following, from somewhere in Scotland. A man and woman who had been drinking went home to bed, and the woman caused the death of a baby by overlaying it. Both the man and the woman were brought before the court on the charge of manslaughter for causing the death by culpable negligence of the infant. In accordance with the evidence, the woman who had overlaid the baby was convicted and sentenced to 6 months' imprisonment, and naturally the man who had not done so was released. Now, in the judgment of my feminist friend, in other matters sane enough, the fact that the man who had not committed any offence was let off, while his female companion, who had, was punished, showed the bias of the court in favour of the man. Surely this is a noteworthy illustration, and glaring as it is, of how all judgment is completely overbalanced and destroyed in otherwise judicial minds, of how such minds are completely hypnotized by the adoption of the feminist dogma. As a matter of fact, of course, the task my friend set himself to do was hopeless. As against the cases which daily occur all over the country of flagrant injustice to men and partiality to women on the part of the courts, there is, I ventured to assert, not to be found a single case within the limits of the four C's of a judicial decision in the contrary sense, i.e. of one favouring the man at the expense of the woman. This sex hatred, so often vindictive in its character, of men for men, which has for its results that man-made laws invariably favour the opposite sex, and that man-administered justice follows the same course, is a psychological problem which is well worth the earnest attention of students of sociology and thinkers in general.